Welcome to the Story Night podcast, where you hear true stories on a theme, recorded live on stage and without notes. I'm your host, Jessica Holmes. Today, we celebrate the one-year birthday of our little prodigy of a program with stories of growing pains and rites of passage from our April 2011 show, Coming of Age. First, featured storyteller Josh Gross serves real time for a juvenile crime he didn't commit.
This is actually the first time I've ever been nervous doing this. And it didn't help that you announced it as a bris. That's not something you want to walk on stage for, really. Usually I have some sort of idea what I'm going to say when I get up here, at least like a general arc. But when we're talking about this particular story, I have absolutely no idea where to start. Because when you're talking about like the defining story of your life, where do you start? But moreover, if you're still alive, where does it end? Think about that. Three things you should probably know. There's a good chance I'm going to drop the F-bomb because I do that, so earmuffs. Second thing, I may run a little long because this story runs about 400 pages in my last attempt to write it down. Yeah, now you're regretting putting me on first, huh? And third thing, it may not make any sense. And that's partially why I have such a trouble figuring out where to start, is because despite 15 years of puzzling over this thing, I still don't really understand it. And I don't talk about it that often, because it's very cumbersome. But there reaches a point where I kind of have to, and it's usually about the fourth time I meet someone, because that's when they notice that I have a very pronounced limp. I don't know why they don't notice it beforehand, but for some reason, it's usually about the fourth time. And for a while, I tried to lie. I tried to tell people that I was hit by a drunk driver to encourage them not to drink and drive. But I'm not a very good liar. I would snicker immediately afterwards. Don't drink and drive. Which didn't really do much for the message of not drinking and driving either, so that was a failed plan. But the other option was to tell them the truth, that I caught an 8-inch piece of shrapnel from a pipe bomb in the leg. And then I did a lot of time in youth prison for it. And that's a much bigger story. And it opens a lot of questions, which makes it very complicated. And mostly it dominates the conversation when you're meeting someone for the first time. You don't get to know them very well when you're going on and on and on about your time in youth prison. And then I met this murderer, and then I met that murderer, and we hung out and we played volleyball. What are you doing? Can I have your phone number? No. But looking back on it, it starts with a friend of mine named Micah. Met Micah around the 8th grade. And Micah was the kind of guy who liked to build things. He made a stun gun out of a flashlight. He taped bicycles to a couch, and then we drove that down the street. Things like that. So when we got to high school, he, of course, immediately signed up for all the shop classes, which allowed him to make things like a 30-pound solid steel lawn dart that would stick into the sidewalk. But the key thing to remember here is that I say that Micah liked to build things, not that he was good at building things. That couch car, for example, lasted about a block and a half before we nearly died. It was sort of a sport to get someone else to ride in one of his inventions and wait for it to self-destruct. So when I walked into the welding shop one day, and he showed me a cannon that he had welded out of a small piece of pipe, closing one end off, putting little brackets on it, and drilling a hole, I should have known better. Especially when he said, "We're going to weld this to the hood of your car, and that way the jocks won't be able to fuck with us anymore." Now, it's a novel approach to deal with bullying, I'll admit that. Not a smart one. Luckily, I shot that down, but we walked across the campus. I didn't think a thing about it. We threw it in the car. We went to lunch. Nothing. Until I went to his house a couple weeks later. He pulled it out, and he loaded it up with a little bit of gunpowder and a wick from a firecracker and a piece of potato, and he said, "Light it." And I said, "Fuck you. You get someone else to do that. This is a spectator sport." So he did, and we ran. And he shot this piece of potato at a birdhouse, and the bird screamed and ran, and we thought it was hysterical, and we were rolling on the ground laughing. No problem. We threw it into the back of the car. We drove into town, went to my house. A couple people we knew showed up. We said, "You got to see this fucking thing." And he set it up again. But this time he loaded it with a giant fishing weight. And I wasn't really paying attention. That's my fault. I definitely take responsibility for that. But by most reports, he poured in roughly 6 ounces of gunpowder. Available over the counter for anyone who wants to reload shotgun shells to hunt, by the way. But no, hey, we don't need gun regulations. Anyway, there was a loud noise, so loud that it eclipsed all other noises. My train tracks ran near my house, and people thought two trains had collided in my backyard. Not that I knew that. I just knew that I tried to take a step, my leg buckled, and suddenly people were running everywhere and screaming, and I didn't exactly know what was going on. I was told that no one actually called the police, that they had just heard the explosion and showed up, which I don't doubt. I woke up in the hospital around 3 a.m. with metal bars through my leg, screaming because I thought my foot had been cut off. Didn't really know where I was. Didn't know what was going on. I was there about 8 days. The shattered knee. I got let out the wheelchair that actually my mom had. This is a really inconvenient side note, but my mom had remodeled the house so that my wheelchair didn't fit down the hallway to the bathroom. So if you're ever going to remodel your house, take that into account, because I got to tell you, that was very inconvenient. And Micah just got sent to go live with his dad for a while. And that was pretty bad. I was kind of crippled for life. They were basically telling me, don't ever walk again, or at least try not to. But to make it worse, about a week and a half after I got out of the hospital, I was called in to the juvenile correction department to see a guy named Ken Chapman. And this is one of those things where people always change the names to protect the innocent, and I always use this guy's fucking name because he's a dick and I want everyone to know it. This guy was so evil. It's like meeting Dick Cheney. He even had an eye patch. Seriously, who works in a juvenile correction facility with a fucking eye patch? He wore this terrible cheap suit, and he just sort of smelled like bad aftershave. And I've always thought of him as a different kind of pedophile. And he started accusing me of things. Things that I had never heard of. Things I really did not understand in the slightest. And I got very defensive because, you know, I was sort of whacked up on morphine and in a lot of pain and in a wheelchair and having to poop in a bucket in the kitchen. And I really wasn't in the mood to take crap from a dick and an eye patch. But what sort of came out was that, and this is where it gets a little wonky, Micah had also made a flyer with a picture of the dean of students on it that said, reward, or wanted dead or alive, preferably dead, reward one carton of cigarettes. It was hysterical. Everyone had one. They took them home and they put them on dartboards and they threw in things, but I had stuck it proudly in the window of my car. So what they decided was that we were planning to assassinate the dean of students of our high school, and that I was injured testing the weapon of his demise. Because that makes total sense. I was sentenced to 13 years in prison. Now, the charges were primarily building a pipe bomb. Now, the first thing to remember is that I can't weld. In fact, I'd failed welding one. Micah was in welding three. You'd think that would sort of clear the issue up, but apparently not. But really what it came down to was that he had said, yeah, I did it. Throw the book at me. I deserve it. I kind of fucked up. And I was like, guys, I'm kind of busy. I think I made a mistake. I think I learned my lesson, and I think I'm going to be hobbling on that lesson for the rest of my life. And to issue a direct quote from one of the officials involved, I'm right, you're wrong, and you're guilty because you're under 18. That was my first lesson in the ways of the world. That our justice system does really not make a lot of sense, especially when it comes to dealing with kids. At first, jail was kind of cool. And I know you're thinking, what? But you gotta understand, I'd been in my house for a really long time, and I was happy to be anywhere. and we got to play volleyball, and they made me a cake on my birthday, and my mom wasn't yelling at me. Instead, it was some surly guy who I could yell back at, and it was okay, because they were supposed to do that sort of thing. But that didn't last very long, because then they sent me to the State Youth Correctional Facility in Oregon. It's called McLaren. Two things happen off the bat. The first is that they search your butt for drugs. I don't really know why. They just do it, man. I'm just telling you what happened. And then the second thing is I got sort of sent into the general population, and I sat down on this bench, because I came in when everyone else was out at lunch. And this giant hairy guy who had crags in his face that made him look like he was 50. This guy had been riding a Harley before there were Harleys, and he was 15. He just came and he threw one beefy arm right around my neck, and he said, "What are you in for?" And I said, "Pipe bomb." And he said, "What were you going for, a preschool or a church?" And he turned out to be my best friend in that place. So that was the second part of my education there. Things are not what they appear. Because there was hundreds of kids in that place. I think there's a general population of around 1,000. And there were a lot of them who were in there for things that I had done myself. Smoked the pot, got in a little bit of trouble, maybe let the air out of a car tire on a Friday night. And they were horrible people. Horrible fucking people. But you know who was really nice? Murderers. They were so easy to get along with. Not because of some sort of moral flexibility on my part, but because they were grounded, because they didn't have this sort of asinine ego that they had to throw up at every single thing. They knew they were there for a while, and they were just going to sit down and keep it quiet and stick it out. Everyone else wanted to make a big scene. That was weird. We had to do things like go to a school. So, you know, it's part of it, so you have to sort of keep kids roughly on track. But this school we had to go to, I mean, ignoring that the teachers had pretty much given up for the most part because they knew what was going on, the only two required classes there were drugs and alcohol and parenting, which really sort of showed you what they thought of us. I actually graduated from high school in that place. I got my GED. We had this sad little ceremony where they gave us like robes to put on over our little jumpsuits, and they played the song on a boombox, and this guy, who I think was there for some sort of bizarre sex offense with a dog, talked to his entire family who'd come in from, you know, a couple towns over about this whole, you know, about how proud he was, and this was this big defining moment, and he was going to be there for another 6 years. That's weird. Especially because you got to remember, one of the biggest things that was happening is that I happened to be there at this weird point in history where Oregon had just passed this thing called Measure 11. You probably don't know what that is here, but Measure 11 was this measure pushed through by the private prison industry to have mandatory minimum sentences. The biggest thing that that did is it took a lot of crimes that juveniles committed and it made them adult crimes. So what that meant is, juvenile sentences, which had initially been on, say, sliding scales, where they say, you know what, you messed up, but we're going to keep you here till we sort of straighten you out and then put you out on the streets so your life isn't completely destroyed by being in the system. Those kids were now there for 8, 10, 15 years, going in at 13 and never coming out. There was one kid in there I met who, admittedly, he messed up pretty bad, but he was high on heroin, and he went into a 7-Eleven with a steak knife, and he stole $12. He was doing 8 years mandatory, and that kid was never going to be normal again. He should have been in a drug treatment program, but instead, he was there. But the real problem was that these prisons weren't able to deal with this thing, because the population doubled in the space of about 2 years. So what they just started doing was throwing up substandard housing. There was hundreds of kids living in weird airline hangar tents surrounded by concrete wire and gravel. And no one knew about it, because they just thought that we were getting tough on crime. And I watched that happen from the inside, too. That's an education. That tells you what priorities are. But every month, I had this caseworker that came up to talk to me. His name was Matt. He wasn't evil. He didn't have an eye patch. But he certainly was a dick. He was just schmarmy, you know? Like he'd been on the tennis team in college or something like that, and he just really thought that it made him better than me. Because it's a sort of taken for granted thing. It's like that old Shawshank Redemption thing. Everyone says they're not guilty. Lawyer screwed you. Yeah, but what if you really aren't? What if you didn't do the thing that they think you did? And they get you in this Quetch 22 where they say, don't lie to us, but don't tell us what we want to hear. Well, what do you want from me? I'm trying to tell you what I did and didn't do, and you want me to take responsibility for things that I didn't do, and you don't want me to lie to you, and you won't let me out until you do satisfy whatever these bizarre, you know, games are that you want from me. And so here I sit, frustrated, confused, angry, and crippled. With murderers, because they play good volleyball. Eventually, after about 9 months, because I was lucky enough not to have a mandatory sentence, after about 9 months of getting in absolutely no trouble whatsoever, because, I mean, really, comparatively, not a big deal, I was transferred to a halfway house in Portland. All told, I was in assorted juvenile facilities for about just over a year. If you factor in a lot of the time I spent on house arrest, it comes closer to a year and a half. They got sent home on parole after a certain point and all these things. And my life at that point was very, very strange, because that's that point when you have those rites of passage, that senior, junior, senior year in high school. I got taken out of my life 1 month into junior year. And that's the point where you say, I get out all my yah-yahs, I do all the things, I transition, I become an adult. The closest things we have to, like, in America, to going out in the woods and fighting a puma like you would in a tribal culture. You know, we don't do that. We should. That'd be way cooler than learning to drive. And I came back, and I was sort of bizarre, because I was like, hey, guys, I'm back. Let's get right back to where we were. And they're like, yeah, no, fuck that. We're going to college. And I was like, no, let's not do that for another year and 6 months. Let's have fun. And they're like, no. And so my friends got a year younger. And then they got another year younger. And then they got another year younger. Because I've been sort of taken out of time. Living this sort of perpetual thing where I'd failed to have that transition to adulthood, to really understand and be move into the adult world. But that changed when I ran into Matt on the street. That fucking schmarmy tennis team douchebag. I wish I could remember his last name so I could tell you about that too. Because I really, these people suck. Everyone should know it. And he was out on the town having fun with his friends, going from bar to bar. And I was out doing the same, except, you know, we couldn't go into the bars, so we just sort of sat there and, like, yelled shit outside them because we were kind of like that. And my friends, I pointed him out, and I said, I told him who he was, and they freaked out because they knew everything that I'd been through. They'd been there through it. They knew that while I may have made some mistakes, I really hadn't done all of these things that they thought that I did, and it became this sort of giant symbol of the travesties of the justice system to everyone about my age. So they started yelling at him. They started calling him names. They started doing exactly what should have been done. And of course, he comes over and he gets in our face and he starts yelling at me. And he says to me, what are you so mad about? And I say, what am I so mad about? I did a year in jail for something I didn't do. And he starts laughing at me. And he says, a year? You were there 2 months, man. This is the guy who's entrusted with my case, with my life, with everything. And he didn't even know how long I was there. That was our justice system. And that was the point where I realized that all these childish notions that I'd had, that people on top had some sort of semblance of what was going on, and that there was some sort of sense of justice or right in the world, were nonsense. And I was right up there with everyone else. And you had to just deal with the situation in front of you. And that was the moment when I think I truly grew up. No justice in the world. Well, that's not entirely true. Some years later, someone told me they saw Micah getting arrested on World's Dumbest Criminals for driving a couch down the street. Justice. Thank you.
Now, it's your turn for a transformative experience. We've extended the featured storyteller submission deadline for our May event one more week. So email a summary of your true story on the theme, parental guidance, stories of direction and misdirection from mom and dad, to storystorynight@live.com by May 9th. Next, we hear from Story Slam winner Donna Vasquez, who finds a silver lining in the aging process.
So this coming-of-age story has to do with, I'm 21 years old, and I'm in college, and I go to the hairstylist, and he goes, oh, my God, I've never seen anything like this. And I'm like, bugs or what? No, I thought he found the scar and the bump on the back of my head from when I fell as a kid on the concrete and slammed it. And he goes, no, look. And he shows me in the mirror, and he goes, you have this gray hair that's gradually back to your dark hair. So it started, it's at the root, it was white, and gradually turning, you know, back to my dark color. And I said, oh, my God, that's my first gray hair. And he goes, do you want me to pull it? And I'm like, no, that's my gray hair. That's my first one. Leave it in. And so, that's mine. I love it. So, you know, then I'm around a boyfriend, and I said, hey, check this out. The hairstylist found this gray hair. It's my first one. And he goes, bend over, let me see it. And I bend over, and I show it to him, and he goes, and all of a sudden I'm like, ow! He pulled the damn hair out. And I said, I was so mad. I was livid. I said, how dare you pull out my first gray hair? I said, give me that thing. And I looked at it, and I inspected it, and it was so beautiful. You know, it was white, and it got red, and then it got brown, you know. I said, okay, whatever. And then I went, oh, my God, there's that wives' tale. For every gray hair you pull out, three more grow in its place. I said, no, you sped it all up now. And so 10 years go by, and, you know, just a few gray hairs come in here and there, and nothing is really noticeable. I get married, and all of a sudden one day my husband says, you have old hair. You should dye it. And I go, excuse me? Because I was out of character for him, and he never would tell me how to do my hair, or never did any of that, which that's what I loved about him. He didn't tell me what to do, and I knew a lot of women whose spouses or boyfriends would tell them how to wear their hair. And I just kind of thought about it, and I resisted, and all of a sudden I went, dang, I should dye my hair. So I go into the stylist, and I say, okay, do something different. And she goes, how about this really cool burgundy, you know, dark, dark color? You won't see it until the sun hits. And I'm like, go for it. She had to do that hair like two or three times because the gray was so resistant. And she said, that's exactly what she said. Your gray hair is resistant. I said, all right. It doesn't want to change. It wants to, you know, it's there. It wants to be seen. And I'm like, okay. You're not going to charge me extra for that, are you? And she's like, no, it's okay. I'm learning how to deal with this. I'm like, okay. And then I'm pregnant. And I realize, oh, chemicals, can't dye your hair. Can't dye your hair. It harms the unborn child. So I start researching and I find a vegetable hair dye. I try henna, which is a muddy mess. And so this gel vegetable hair dye works beautifully. It's not going to harm my baby. So I use that forever. And it's a monthly process. Every first of the month, you got that little strip of gray hair and you got to dye it. And so that was my monthly routine. Every now and then, I would pull out that mascara wand. My aunt told me this trick. She goes, you know, on those days when you just don't have time and you have to be somewhere and people are going to see you, you just take that little mascara wand and you just rub it right there and you blend it in and nobody can tell. You'll pass. And I'm like, okay, cool. This, we would have made a mint before, you know, this was before they invented that touch-up wand. So, okay, whatever. And I kept wanting to let it go, but I was in a high-profile position as an executive director of a nonprofit, and I was on TV, and I would do all these things in public. And I thought, there's no way I can let myself kind of go. And finally, I resigned from that job, and I'm like, oh, okay. Now, divorce that other husband. now I'm remarried. And he was very supportive. And I said, I think I want to let the gray. He goes, go for it. And I'm like, okay, cool. I'm home. I'm not working. I'm going to let it go. I go to visit my family in California. About 2 inches of roots right there, right? My aunt, you got to understand I'm Mexican. And my family's very loud, very boisterous. And my aunt goes, oh, no, you don't, Vasquez. Oh, no, you don't. And I'm like, what? And she goes, don't even go there. And I'm like, Margot, the gig is up. Your niece has old hair. You're the aunt. You're older. Guess what? You have gray hair, too. And now people are going to know how old you are. So they started laughing about it. And they're like, oh, shaking their head. I had so little support from all of my relatives. It was crazy. Thank God I live in Idaho. And they live in California. So, oh, no. So end of the story is I start getting compliments on my white hair, and women come up to me and go, oh, your hair is beautiful, you know, and I think all of you with the white hair, go for it, thank you. And, you know, and I influenced my mother, and now she let hers go. So it worked on the reverse order, and I influenced her.
Thank you for listening. Story Story Night is brought to you by presenting partner the Boise State Story Initiative, venue partner the Lennon Building, design partner Neighborhood All-Stars, and our broadcast partner Boise State Public Radio. Please donate now at radio.boisestate.edu. Our Story Story Night theme and podcast production are by Dan Costello. Hear more at hearcostello.com. Please join us next week for more stories from coming of age. Learn more at storystorynight.org.